Today's episode of Locked On MLB is brought to you by Built Bar. Go to BuiltBar.com and use promo code Locked On. You'll get 20% off your next order.
You are Locked On MLB. Your daily MLB podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans, and welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. This is the daily podcast. We talk about all of Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully. On today's episode, I'm going to be playing part of an interview that I did a little while ago with Glenn Braggs, who was a outfielder for the Cincinnati Reds when they won the World Series in 1990, and he had a couple of truly eye-opening highlights in that postseason. This show is available on the free and easy-to-use Himalaya podcasting app, and we're available wherever you get your podcasts. When you're staying at home during these memorable times, let's just be kind, be sure to tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On MLB, or check out some of the other great shows on the Locked On Podcast Network, including Locked On Fantasy Baseball with Scott Cullen and Locked On Reds with Jeff Carr. You can send your Sunday requests to my Twitter account, which is at Sully Baseball, and the show's Twitter account is at Locked On MLB Pod. Well, look, I have a bunch of stuff I'm going to be doing this week, including an episode where I talk about the Yankees and the Mets and the Mets' pursuit of Francisco Lindor and how successful that was, and the Yankees' non-pursuit of DJ LeMahieu and how unsuccessful that's been. I originally was going to drop that for today, but I'm not going to lie to you, it's getting a little bit late, but I'm not going to leave you without a show today. I originally did this for the Old Sully Baseball Daily Podcast, and I thought you would all appreciate it, as Glenn Braggs, who was a very kind and generous person when he was on the phone with me, talked about that memorable 1990 season when the Reds won the World Series. But that year for him began in Milwaukee as a member of the Brewers. So please enjoy my discussion with Glenn Braggs.
Hey, Sully, how you doing?
Hey, how are you? I should tell you this because during the postseason, I did something called the Unsung Postseason Hero of the Day. And okay. It's like on that calendar day, someone did something which may not be Carlton Fisk's homer or Joe Carter's homer or Roy Halladay's no-hitter, but something that we should celebrate for that day. And you were the unsung postseason hero of the day, commemorating the catch in Game 6 of the NLCS. So,
oh, wow, that's pretty awesome, man.
You and Billy Bates both got unsung heroes, both in the same trade, both got an unsung hero.
Exactly right. Both of us were pretty happy with that trade.
I mean, for those of you who don't remember, that you were a member of a Brewers team that was a really fun Brewers team with a lot of really fun players and everything. And in the middle of the 90s season, when the Brewers are having a bit of a downturn, the Brewers swung a deal with the Reds, and the two players came in had huge, huge impact in the Reds winning the World Series in ways you wouldn't necessarily think. So why don't you, if you could just tell me, what was that like when you found out that you're being dealt from Milwaukee and jumping in the middle of that Lou Piniella craziness in Cincinnati?
That was quite a day. I remember quite well. I remember showing up at the ballpark and taking some batting practice and then being called into the manager's office. At that time was Tom Treblehorn. Mm-hmm. And he calls me into his office, which wasn't totally unusual, but I wasn't expecting for him to tell me that I had gotten traded. So I got into the office and he basically just jumped right in and just told me that I had been traded. And my initial reaction was one of sadness because I'd come up with the Brewers through the minor leagues, most of the guys. I just, I was actually kind of shocked and was saddened by the news of being traded. And then I asked him which team did I got, that I get traded to, and he said the Cincinnati Reds. Now, I have to tell this quick story. When I was I grew up in Southern California,
right.
You know, where you have the Dodgers and the Angels, and my dad was a really big Dodger fan. But as when I was growing up, I was a huge Reds fan. The fact that I was going to get over there and play for my favorite team growing up was just something that I just couldn't have dreamed of. When I got there, my first thought was just to make sure that I just didn't screw things up. You know, I wanted to get over there and contribute and not, you know, mess up the flow.
Right.
And the guys just they welcomed me in, and they just took me in, and I just felt like a teammate right from day one. And you know, I've heard this story from the guys that were there the previous years with Pete Rose and them telling me stories about how I think the team had finished maybe runner up the two or three previous seasons, and it was basically the same team that year in 1990 that we went wire to wire all the way to the World Series. And when Pinella got in, he asked Tony Perez, you know, why is this team, you know, languishing in second place every year? And Perez told him they need somebody to kick them in the butts, really, literally. They need somebody to get to stir it up and to really get in their butts and make them play. And, you know, there's no person that would fit that bill any better than Lou Pinella. So he did come in, and he put his foot down. I mean, he was one of the best managers I ever played for. Yeah, we had you know, Eric Davis, which was our, you know, he was our godfather. He was a guy that was basically, you know, that everybody looked up to. We had Barry Larkin, Billy Hatcher as well, were kind of like the spokesman for the team. Those guys, they kept it loose. They really knew. You know, it was one of the best teams that I ever played for, where everybody, there were no cliques on the team. Everybody played together. We went out, we ate together on the road, and, you know, we just enjoyed being around each other, and it was just a lot of fun. I think going back to what you said about Luke using a lot of different lineups, I think, you know, again, that was his MO. That was what he liked to do, and that's what he was really good at. But we really knew what our roles were going to be. We just knew what to expect when we got to the park. And when the player is comfortable in his role and he knows what his role is, it makes it a lot easier for the guys to go up there and perform. And I think a lot of managers could really learn a lesson from that, because you know, we just knew that if we were called upon, we were going to be ready, because we knew what our role was. And we did. We had lots of different lineups. I remember when I first got traded over there, I went on a pretty hot tear for the first two or three weeks that I was there, because he was just plugging me in all the right situations. I mean, I just felt comfortable being at the plate and just knowing what my role was coming over there. He was just amazing at that. So I think that was probably one of the biggest reasons why we knew if he called on Quiñones to come up and hit, Quiñones comes up big, you know, all the time. One of the best pinch hitters that we had on the team at that time. And, you know, we had Mariano Duncan. I mean, that team was just a solid team all the way around defensively. And as again, we didn't have Eric Davis and Barry Larkin were probably our biggest two stars on that team. Everybody
but they
else
didn't have,
was,
that was not either one of their best seasons, though. If you actually look
that's
at statistics,
that's exactly right. That's,
yeah,
I kind of looked at our team a little bit like how Kansas City plays.
Yeah,
like, you know, the Royals play. I mean, that team, that Kansas City team, is very similar to that Reds team that we had, because they have those three guys coming out of the bullpen that are just lights out. We had the Nasty Boys.
Yeah.
We knew that if the game, we knew if we had to leave after the sixth inning, it was going to be pretty much over. And so, I mean, that's what you have to do if you're going to take it all the way to the World Series. You got to get a little lucky, but we played solid defensively all season long. I believe we were at the very top defensively for the whole season. And, you know, and we got big hits. Not a big home run hitting team or anything like that. It was just the guys that put the ball in play and got the big hits when it was necessary.
Back to my conversation with Glenn Braggs. Cincinnati Reds postseason hero.
Well, let me ask you a question, because you said something that I found interesting, that when you were traded over from Milwaukee that in June, you said that when you came over to the Reds, like, the guys came up to you as if you were a teammate with them all along. Like, who is, like, the first? I mean, this is something I wondered. I'll never be in a major league clubhouse as a player. That my ship has sailed. So, if, like, when you go into a clubhouse, like, who is, like, the first person to come up to you and say, "Hey, Glenn, good to meet you. Welcome aboard." I mean, who is the first one to kind of embrace you, or that you remember sort of making you feel at home?
One of the guys that showed up early was Jack Armstrong, pitcher.
Oh yeah,
and he had a solid year that year. Mm-hmm. Went, like, I think it was a starter in the All-Star game.
He was,
year.
Yeah.
Jack Armstrong. Like, you know, I like to work out, and I've always been pretty physically fit. And when I can, you know, when Jack walks into the locker room, Jack, pretty big guy, very physically fit. And he, you know, first thing he said, "Man, you're going to fit in perfectly with this team," you know, because they had a lot of guys that like to train and work out hard. And so Jack Armstrong welcomed me in. He was, you know, we kind of clicked right away because we had the same type of, you know, workout regimen. And so we start talking about that. Then guys start filing in, Eric Davis and Barry Larkin. Those are the guys that really kind of, you know, one of the things that they, you know, that they, the first thing they do is they start to joke and kid around with you, and mm-hmm. then that's when you know that everything is all good. And, you know, they just told me, you know, one of the very first things that Eric Davis told me when I when he came into the clubhouse that day, he said, "Welcome to the big leagues." So, you know, so, you know, because they thought the National League was the real league, so... But that's one of the things that they did. They just, you know, they just kind of, you know, took me in as their own teammate. And right away, man, I just fit right in. And I just felt very comfortable. And it was just great.
And you were in a, there was no shortage of interesting characters on that team. And you had Paul O'Neill was on that team. And,
right. Well, I'll tell you, one of the most interesting characters was one of the Nasty Boys. Actually, all three of the Nasty Boys were interesting characters.
Yeah.
But Randy Myers probably took the cake. I mean, my locker was right next to Randy Myers.
Right.
And Randy Myers, he had these big, you know, machetes in his locker. He had, like, grenades in there. I never asked him if it was a real live grenade. You know, he had a taser that he tased Lou Piniella with one time. I mean, this dude was just, he was way out there, man. But, you know, there were a lot of characters. I mean, you take Rob Dibble, you know, he was a character. Norm Charlton, we called him the professor because he had 3 degrees.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah, that guy was, he was a sharp cookie, man. That guy was amazing. And so we had a lot of care. Luis Quiñones was the guy that kind of kept everybody loose in the clubhouse.
Mm-hmm. You know, you get to experience something that as a fan, being the idea of ever being on a team that wins the World Series is, that's just like, that's, if you put Aladdin's lamp and get, you know, I had 3 wishes from the genie, that's one of the ones I would say, and you were able to experience that. And be able to experience it with a city that really appreciated it, and also with players, like, that's the only championship that Larkin ever got, the only championship that Eric Davis ever got, or Riho, or some of the other, you know, great players who were on that team.
Right,
and
right.
That Game 6 between the Pirates and the Reds was a, if those of you who don't remember, it was a very weird game, because Leland started a reliever. He started Ted Power because he knew that Piniella loved to platoon. So he was going to have a right-hander start and then bring a left-hander
exactly.
out of the pen.
That's right. Zane Smith was supposed to start.
Right.
And then I think they were going to go with Drabeck in Game 7 if we got that far. Yeah, it was really brilliant. And Danny Jackson, man, that guy was a stud, man.
Yeah.
I mean, Danny Jackson was just he was a gamer.
But you didn't even start. You came in as a defensive replacement.
It was a double switch, basically.
Oh, okay.
You know, where it's late in the game. I think it was like the ninth inning. Yeah, it was the ninth
or ninth inning. Yeah.
Yeah, and they just said no doubles. those are the little things in a postseason that can give you wins or losses. If we're not, if I'm playing in just slightly or playing at normal depth, I don't get that ball. We're down 3-2 now.
Yeah, for those of you who don't remember, I'm just going to fill in a little bit of the detail, because you and I remember it, like you were there,
right.
And I have that kind of memory that I remember this. But the Reds were on the verge of clinching the pennant in front of 56,000 at Riverfront Stadium, and it was 2-1, Reds lead, and Randy Myers was pitching for Cincinnati, and Barry Bonds walked, so he was the tying run. And Carmelo Martinez, who was a big, one of those big slugging right-handed guys, represented the go-ahead run. But the Pirates were on the verge of elimination. They were down to the last two outs. And Carmelo Martinez hit a drive, as you described. It was a line. It was a laser beam that looked like it was going to be a go-ahead on the verge of elimination home run, which would have been, you know, like the Dave Henderson home run. It would have been one of those home runs that we talk about forever just because of the drama behind it. And it would have set up Doug Drabek pitching Game 7, which would probably have been a Pirate win. I mean, in all...
Most likely.
And so Mr. Braggs, my guest, ran up, left. Now, tell me your what's going on, because you left... You, it was... An inch away, that game was an inch away from becoming the Carmelo Martinez game. And they're showing it on MLB and Carmelo Martinez having a street named after him in Pittsburgh.
Exactly.
Tell me what was going on in your brain at that moment, because it was such a dramatic moment.
Right. You know, when the ball was initially hit, all I told myself was to get back on it, because I really didn't think it was out of the ballpark, because it was a liner.
Right.
But the thing just kept going and kept going, and I got back to the wall, and when I got back to the wall, I was kind of drifting back just a hair, because I was already playing deep.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to the wall and I had a beat on it all the way, because I was watching it all the way, it was just right there. All I had to do was jump up and get it. It was probably about a foot over the wall.
Yeah.
And I got up and caught it and brought it back. And then initially, my first thought then was to get the ball back in the Larkin, at Barry Larkin, because Barry Bonds had a chance to kind of, you know, to maybe get to second base. We didn't want that tying run on second. So.
Right.
That was my initial thought. Once I caught it to get back to the wall, and you know, once I caught it and got back to the wall and caught it, I needed to get that ball in. It didn't even sink into me until moments later, when the crowds was going nuts, that was a home run. All I just thought about was getting back to make the catch and throw it in the second base. And once I realized it, it was like the greatest feeling in the world, but I knew we still had one more out to go. We still had one more out to go. So, you know, it was the greatest feeling in the world, especially once we won that game. I mean, I was not a guy that was known as a defensive guy, but, you know, one of the biggest things that happened in my career was a defensive play. And,
right.
You know, which was really satisfying to me. So, and it was also the play really that propelled us to the World Series. So we were not afraid of any team. We were not afraid of any team. When you know, we laughed, like when we just had our 25th celebration, we look at the game one introductions and we look at the picture of that, and we were all laughing at how relaxed we were. Because we were not afraid of the A's, and we knew that we could beat them. We had the pitching, we had the defense, and we just needed to you know, bang together some hits, and we did in Game 1 and Game 3 and won two close ones.
Occurred to me. This didn't even hit me until you were just describing it. The Pirates had the Cy Young Award winner in Drabek,
right,
and the MVP in Bonds.
In Bonds.
The
That's right.
A's had the Cy Young Award winner in Welch, and they also had Stewart, and they had the MVP in Ricky Henderson.
Right.
So you faced all the MVPs and Cy Young Award
winners. That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it was, but we were a very confident team, not cocky, just a very confident team. And like I said, when we saw that picture of the introductions for Game 1 of the World Series in 1990, we just were laughing at how relaxed we were. We must not have known, you know, any better, because, you know, we should have been scared out of our wits playing against the great A's and,
right,
you know, the Pirates. We really had to beat two really, really good teams to win that that World Series that year. But there was another incident, and not an incident, but a thing that happened in Game 4.
Yeah.
And we all thought of it as being very symbolic. I think it was around the eighth inning. Stewart was on the mound, and I think the score was tied, or they may have been up a run, and there was a balloon that floated onto the field. Do you know this story?
I do, but I'm going to let you tell.
There's a balloon that floated onto the field,
right,
and right toward Dave Stewart, mm-hmm, and he grabs it and he pops it, and right then we thought, that's it. Their balloon is popped. We just bursted their balloon. We're going to win this game, and we ended up winning that game. I think 2-1 or 3-2, very, very, very close game. I think we ended up scoring in the ninth, and Riho pitched an unbelievable game.
Right.
Jose Riho pitched an unbelievable, he pitched great in game one, came back in game four and pitched an amazing game, and he was yelling at us to score runs for him. And we had opportunities. I think we had a couple of innings where we had bases loaded and didn't score. And
you drove in the tying run on the bases loaded. It was 1-0 with nobody out, and you grounded out, and I guess you beat out a double
play.
It was
basically a fielder's choice. A fielder's choice. I think I had a fan tell me that me and two other players, which are both pitchers, are the only guys in World Series history to have, I think, either game-tying RBIs with no hits. So I was wow. Well, gee, thanks, man. Definitely would take it. They were both big RBIs. They both tied. Game 2 tied the score. Game 3 tied the score. I mean, Game 4 tied the score. So very, 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 very good. We just were a very confident team. It's a lot of fun to rehash that and talk about that season and how it all came about. And I really believe that the A's just really took us for granted. I think they just felt like it was bad. I think they believed everything everybody was saying about them. And I believe when they showed up and they saw Jose Riho being our ace, being the guy they were going up against in Game 1, I just felt like they just thought, this is over. We got this guy. We know Jose Riho. And Jose Riho, he was our ace the whole season. That guy is another guy. Like Danny Jackson, these guys are like just gamers. And when you get them in a big game and on a big stage, they come up big. And he certainly did in that Game 1. And I probably Game 4 was the best I had ever seen him pitch.
Yeah.
I mean, he was lights out.
So Carney Lansford pops up to my man Todd Benzinger. And the World Series, were you on the field? I can't remember. Were you on the field?
I was in left field, yeah.
Okay. Was that because, that's because Davis got hurt, that's right.
That's right, yeah. Actually, Davis got hurt and Hatcher, then he leaves the game, and I come in, I was the very first batter up in the second inning, and that was my famous breaking the bat on the pitch.
That's right.
Yeah. And the funny part to me about that whole scenario is how Tim McCarver and Jack Buck are talking about me as I'm coming up to the plate, talking about like I'm built like a football player and he's so strong. And then I swing and break the bat and how they go nuts over it. It's just kind of like almost like they set up me going up there and swinging and breaking the bat like that. So it was but that was great. But yeah, I was in left field when the game ended, and it was jubilation and, you know, amazing joy from just about everybody. I mean, we finally brought a championship back to Cincinnati, which had not been there since the 70s.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't imagine just that the like the clubhouse and the parade. I mean, that just is sort of like, you know, that's the thing you can't buy. It's that moment of like, yeah, I got a ring, I got my championship.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, we had the great celebration in the clubhouse with the, you know, with the champagne and everything, and that was just incredible. But there was, I don't know if you knew this part of the story, there was no meal or anything like that, you know, prepared for us. So we, our owner at the time was Marge Schott.
Yeah.
And so we actually had to, when we got back to our hotel, we ended up ordering out some fast food. That's what we celebrated with fast food. That is a true story. That is a true story.
Wow.
And our rings, you know, we love our rings. We do. I mean, it's a championship ring. But when you compare our rings to other championship rings, it was almost like she just kind of, how can I say this nicely?
Cracker Jack box?
Yeah. But I love my ring, and I some of the guys ended up modifying their rings. I left mine the way it was because it was a championship ring, a World Series ring, and you know, it was the thing that if you are a baseball player from Little League on up is the thing that you hope happens in your life. You get even opportunity to even play in a World Series, let alone win one. And so definitely the culmination of my career was that, you know, was the icing on the cake was that championship ring.
And I can't help but ask this question. You're in there, you're celebrating, you're there with everyone, Lou Piniella and everybody, and then just pull out this stunning upset. And did at any point your mind say, God, I was traded from Milwaukee this year?
Oh, yeah. Billy Bates and I were looking at each other and saying that.
All right.
I really do appreciate it, man. Thank you, Sully.
Take care.
Thank you so much, Glenn Braggs, and thank you for everyone at Past Pros for setting that up with me a few years ago when I did it for the Sully Baseball Podcast. And thank you all for listening to this podcast. This has been Locked On MLB for the 11th day of January 2021. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully.